Welcome to Open Book on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. This is a program celebrating Pride. My guest is Sam Harris, who is a performer, singer, Broadway star, has several CDs, political activist, has been married for several years. Well, married actually in the interregnum when there actually was gay marriage in California, right. But you've been with your partner for 16 years, and you have a 2-year-old son now, right?
That's right.
Sam Harris, when I've mentioned your name to people, the first thing they say, of course, is Star Search. Though for me, it was seeing you on Broadway in a Cy Coleman show called The Life, and I'd like to talk a little bit in depth about making a Broadway show, because you were one of the stars, if not the star, the protagonist in a way of the show. And it was an original role as opposed to going on tour and shows like Jesus Christ Superstar, Cabaret, or Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yes.
But I kind of want to start a little bit with where you grew up, how you grew up. You were born in 61 in a town called Cushing, Oklahoma. Did you grow up there?
I grew up in an equally small town called Sand Springs, Oklahoma, which was about 30 minutes away from Cushing. My parents grew up in Cushing. I grew up in Sand Springs, which had a small population and was, you know, a rural Oklahoman blue-collar community.
This was in the 60s, but I would guess the 60s did not come into Oklahoma except on television.
That's very true. In fact, I just had this conversation with my parents about how they were at an age, because they were in high school in the 50s, about how they were too old to really be in that generation when the 60s happened. And they were too young, I think, to be a part of the prior generation. They were in this little chunk in the middle, and I think that's what it was like in Oklahoma. I mean, certainly on the news, you know, Kent State, Martin Luther King, all these things were happening, but you would have never really known that where we live. There wasn't a lot of protesting.
You're performing now at the Raz Room in San Francisco through Sunday, and during your performance, you said that you first went on stage, you were like 5 years old, and you were in South Pacific?
Right. My father was the high school band director, and so I got to be in some of the productions. And my first show was South Pacific. I played one of the little Polynesian bastard children, and I sang the little French song, Dites-moi. And I really knew. In fact, you and I were talking about Carol Channing before we started doing this, and Carol, we were at my house and having lunch, and she said, Sam, when did you know that you wanted to be in show business? When did you know this was your calling? And I said, I thought about it, and I knew at 5, sort of, but at 7... is when I knew I had been in this little drama club. My parents had schlepped me to Tulsa to do this little drama class. And we had a 20-minute production in which I was the lead. It was a 20-minute show. I mean, we were 7. And my family was going to take a vacation, the first vacation ever that we had ever taken. Didn't have a lot of money. The only time that it could be was during the time that I was going to do the one performance of this show. And my parents very wisely asked me what I would rather do, go on the 2-week vacation with them or stay home and be in the show. And I chose the show. And they went on, and my grandmother stayed at my house. And they let me make that decision. And I think that's when I really had to look at what was important to me, what I really wanted to be and what I really wanted to do. And when I told Carol Channing, 7, she said, that's the answer that everybody gives.
7 years old.
Isn't that interesting?
I noticed that a lot of people from small towns seem to have the ambition to make it big, and they succeed. And I grew up in New York, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I had that ambition. Maybe it was I didn't have to escape.
Ah, that's true. Well, I think that New York and Los Angeles and big cities where there's centers for music and theater and film, you know, the population is primarily people from other places. I did have to escape. It was a great place to grow up. It was a great place for a sense of family. It was a great place, you know, being a father now of a little child, I look back and recognize, you know, we could go out and we played with the neighbors and everybody was responsible for everybody. That doesn't really exist anymore. So I'm glad I had that upbringing. I left when I was 15. I needed to go. I needed to find like-minded people who wanted what I wanted.
At that point was also the fact that you were gay starting
right.
to emerge as well?
Absolutely. No, I remember vividly being a young teenager and reading psychology books under the covers of my bed with a flashlight to find out what was wrong with me. It was a very different time.
And your parents, were they Bible Belt people?
No, they weren't, and yet they weren't liberal either. You know, everybody was a Democrat in Oklahoma when I was growing up. Now they're all Republican, or at least they vote that way. But that's because the party concepts changed. The conservatism was certainly still there. It was a Bible-thumping, Southern Baptist Bible-thumping.
Were you Southern Baptist?
Certainly. And it was very exciting and theatrical, you know. They'd bang the Bible, and our preacher, his name was Brother Bill, and he would get all excited and turn red and throw his hands in the air, and he had had 4 heart attacks. And so part of the excitement was wondering if he was going to drop dead on the spot. And so it was like theater. It was great theater.
Well, do you think that, you know, I noticed that you're very animated in your performing, and I was thinking, okay, well, you're also an actor.
Yes.
But how much do you think, having grown up in that environment, just like a lot of rap performers grew up in the gospel, you know, the Black Baptist Church, you think growing up in that with seeing that environment also threw you in that direction?
Sure. Well, and also the Black Gospel Church was a big influence on me as well, musically. There's a freedom in that, you know, especially when you feel oppressed yourself.
You went directly to L.A. at that point?
No, I went to St. Louis, and then to Nashville, and then to Los Angeles.
It said on your website you won something called the Frank Sinatra Pop Singing Award?
When I was in college, I finished high school through correspondence courses and then went to UCLA. I went for 2 years, during which time they allowed me to write and produce and star in my own musical, which was a big production, and it took most of the year to pull together. It was the first time that the theater department and the music department had actually come together. It was a big deal, and they really, I mean, it was the best education I could have gotten. I didn't really even take classes my second year there. I just did this. And at the end of that second year, there was also this Frank Sinatra sponsored this pop singing contest and had done it for several years. I did that and met him and heard him, and it was great. You know, I was 19 years old. It was really thrilling.
And from there, you went to Star Search.
From there, I started playing every dump and dive in Los Angeles and sort of discovering who I was. And I had a brilliant, brilliant director named Jerry Blatt, who had worked and written for and directed all of Bette Midler's shows for years and really co-created that persona with her. And he is the one who really taught me about storytelling and honesty, and that anything you do on the stage, if it's organic and it's honest, it goes. If you feel like standing on your head and it's true, then it goes. It's when we start thinking outside of ourselves and we start thinking of what something looks like that it becomes false.
In working on Little Night Music with Catherine Zeta-Jones, I know that Stephen Sondheim kept telling her, don't sing the song Send in the Clowns, talk it, because when you talk it, you're acting. And I get the feeling that great singers have to be great actors.
I consider myself an actor first, certainly.
Yeah.
It's about the words. It's the script. It's the thing from which you interpret a personal point of view. I do that with everything I sing.
Star Search, did they contact you? Did you just try out?
It was the first season, so they hadn't started auditions yet. They were scouting people. And they saw me in some dumpy little place and asked me to then come in and audition. And I auditioned in a tiny room, like a 10-by-5 room with a couch with 8 people sitting on it, and the pianist was in the other room. And I sang some song, I can't recall what it was, and they said, thank you, no thank you. And they thought it wasn't what they were looking for. I think they were looking for something a little bit more pop, strictly pop and contained. And there were 2 people there who said, wait a minute, this is something different, this is something special, and convinced them to put me on the show, and then I remained there for the season.
Well, at that point, what kind of music were you listening to?
Oh, my. A real strange amalgam of certainly musical theater, but also Aretha Franklin and Jackie Wilson and Patti LaBelle, and also great writers, Randy Newman and Tom Waits, people who weren't necessarily singers but were great storytellers, and musical theater and movie music.
The song that put you over the top there was Over the Rainbow, which, of course, up till that point was someone else's specialty song. What prompted you guys to select that?
On Star Search, they let, you know, unlike Idol, I could sing whatever I wanted to sing. I took that song and was certainly influenced by other arrangements. Patti LaBelle had done a 6-8 arrangement of it, and I used that as the basis. Sort of reinterpreted it, and I think ignorance is bliss, you know, when you're, whatever I was, 21, I'm like, why not? And then it did become associated with me, and it's a song that I've sung since.
Well, Sam Harris, at that point, you became kind of a star overnight, I guess. Then the question comes up as a gay person. How did you deal at that time with that?
I didn't. I never lied. It was known in the industry and it was known amongst, you know, my people. But my first record company was Motown. And they made it very clear that I was not to talk about that aspect. It's so funny. When I would do press, when I would do interviews, when I was on tour. And, you know, when you're on tour, you do 20 interviews a day. Or you set it up in a hotel room. And they were all, you know, the journalists were told, do not ask. Sam doesn't talk about his personal life. Which is code for Sam's gay.
And you've seen that before.
Yeah, well, and I just learned to use, it was horrible. I had to learn to use, you know, broad terms and vague things to never have a, to never identify a he or a she. It was awful.
Did they ever ask you to have a beard or anything?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Really?
No, I took to award shows and events and premieres and things. I would take somebody that was on a TV show or a girl who was, you know, not necessarily pretending that we were, you know, seriously in a relationship, but that it was seen that way. And then I just sort of started breaking that on my own.
How did you break it?
Well, after I left Motown, I just stopped being so protective and so secretive and so, I guess, shameful. And I was in a relationship, and I started being seen. I actually officially came out, I can't even remember what year it was, but too late for me, probably. It was in the 90s, and it was in The Advocate. And it came out officially that Sam Harris was gay, and it was like, duh.
But that was long after you'd become an AIDS activist.
That's true. And in fact, one of the first things that I did as an AIDS activist was Elizabeth Taylor did the very first APLA, AIDS Project Los Angeles event, which was huge. Huge. And this is 1985 or something. I don't know. And I picked up the phone and it was Elizabeth Taylor, who I'd never met. And she said, this is Elizabeth Taylor. And I said, who is this? Who is this? And she said, I would love for you to do this. I'm a big fan, and I love your music, and I would love for you to do this. And I said, of course I will do it. And she said, you're the first person that said yes. No one will say yes. And then somebody else came on board, and then somebody else came on board, and then it became a thing. But everybody was frightened, and the government didn't say the word. And it was then the event turned out to be this wonderful, wonderful, star-studded event.
And how are you involved now with Broadway Cares?
Well, for years and years, you know, when I've been on the road or when I've been on Broadway, I'm grateful to have helped raise millions of dollars for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. I can't even count the number of benefits I've done. And it's always my great pleasure. It's why we're here, you know, really. It's why we're here, is to leave things better than we found them.
You know, over the years, you've become more of a political activist. I know
Yes.
you worked for the Obama campaign.
Mm-hmm.
How did that seep in? What kind of advice were you given? I mean, we're talking in the period when you were the star Sam Harris, before you kind of moved into Broadway and tours and now cabaret.
I don't think I ever noticed. I don't think I really became completely outspoken during that time. When I was asked to do something, I showed up. I think I did. I tried to do the right thing. But I didn't become really, really vocal about things until, I don't know, the last 10 years, I suppose. I'm not really concerned about what somebody thinks. You know, I think of myself as an intelligent, articulate man. I'm a good person. And I get very, very frustrated with ignorance and misinformation. And so I stand up and talk. And if you don't want to hear me, then change the channel.
Well, I think also there's probably more room for it now. And certainly there's more room for gay activism now mm-hmm. than there was at that particular
time. My greatest gay activism is being a husband and a father and a good citizen. That's my gay activism. Every time one of these politicians gets found out, first of all, it's sad. Or anytime somebody goes to the extreme, you know, I'm on those God hates fags people, the Phelps, right. Reverend, I'm on the death list, you know, I'm on the let's kill Sam Harris list. Happiness, you know, that's my political activism. Those people, by the way, showed up in my little town in Sand Springs, Oklahoma, because a student there was trying to start a gay-straight alliance and wanted to go to the prom. And it was in the Washington Post, and it got some attention. Those people went and picketed outside the high school with those horrible, and little children holding up signs about hate and violence. And my mom and dad, they wanted to do something, and there were a number of people in this town that, by the way, would have driven me out on a rail when I was a kid. They did the most extraordinary thing. Those people were standing outside when the kids went into school, protesting those horrible people. And when those kids came out of school, my parents and a number of people in the community were standing in the same spot, sweeping up, silently, just sweeping up, sweeping away the hate and the ugly and being there. And I thought that was a really bold and beautiful move.
Sam Harris, you went on to Broadway and you starred in a groundbreaking show, I think, called The Life, Cy Coleman's show, and I guess you just auditioned and got the part, right?
Yeah, I was called in for this part. The show had been in workshops and development for a really long time, and so a lot of the cast had already been set. And the character that I played is something that had been continued to be developed, and that Cy was writing for new songs, and who became sort of the glue of the show, and the sort of Iago. It was great for me because I had never played a villain. And it was so much fun to play a villain. You know, it's the best.
Well, what was it like working with Cy Coleman? Sweet Charity and
Well, Cy was like a kid. He just got so excited about everything. And he would sit down at the piano and try things out and to be designed upon. And for him to take your voice and your strengths and your what you do and build something on that. I mean, that's the best. It's thrilling. The show has beautiful, beautiful music and a great story. I think the show could have used some editing and some cutting, but, you know, that's the way all shows are. I think it was certainly the best show of the season, and it was an incredible cast. And
Lilias White
was great in it. Yeah, the whole cast was fantastic. It was a pleasure to come to work.
And after that, you got involved in television. You wrote a television show before then, right?
I wrote a show before that, a sitcom that was on for 4 years after The Life. Then I started working on this Jolson show, which has now come back. Then I started touring a lot in concert, and then I did The Producers on Broadway, and then I was in California, and then I did a TV series a couple of years ago on CBS. It was so much fun just to do comedy, too, and not be singing as well.
You do a lot of cabaret. You said you have a new CD out.
My newest actual full CD is called Free, which I wrote a lot of and co-wrote a lot of, which explores all the definitions of free. And, you know, you were talking about being out. There's a song on it called He Is, which is about my relationship. And it's about being independent and open and free and all the things that that means. But more recently, I mean, that came out last year. But I have just co-written a song called My Reclamation, which is basically a marriage equality anthem, which is about demanding equal rights, the rights of a citizen in this country, in a poetic way.
The music business itself, you've been in it for a long time.
It's changed so much.
Yeah, there seems to be a huge fragmentation.
I think what's happening in the music business is very scary for the music business and very exciting, really. Record companies are having to completely rechange the way they thought and did business, and I think that's a really good thing. Independent records, well, now, because of technology, anyone can make a record in their bedroom, and it sounds like my first records had $500,000 budgets. Now you can make a record for $5,000. And because of YouTube, you can market a record. So it enables talent from everywhere to actually create music and even market it. So it's really turned the whole record industry and the whole cash, the payola, marketing, everything, it's turned it upside down in the same way that independent film has changed because of technology. You can make a movie. You can make a webisode. You can make a record. And it's put the power into the hands of the creators and actually let people decide. You know, there are people who are being discovered on YouTube that are getting millions of hits and selling millions of downloaded records because it's good, not because it's been shoved down our throats.
What percentage do you think at this point of your sales come through downloading?
90%.
90%?
Maybe more.
Really?
Yeah.
It's all downloading now.
Yeah. That's what I do. I don't have room for the CDs, and it's all on my computer.
How about royalties? Have you been getting what you should be getting? Because I know that a number of people have been complaining that they're not getting their royalties.
Well, this is another reason that record companies, they had the monopoly on how to control that. I am owed a great deal of money from several record labels that I will never see. One I sued quite substantial, seven figures, you know, that I'll never see, and won. Because, you know, they recoup everything. You record in their studio, and they charge you for their studio. So it's a different world, and I think it's a great thing.
So now do you record at home?
No. I'm I record in a studio. But that studio can be different forms. It's not necessarily, you know, something that you're paying a fortune per hour. And, by the way, the guitarist can do something and send in a track. Right. And we can do the backups in somebody's home studio. And you can do it in lots of different ways. You don't even have to be in the same city.
You did two CDs where you actually had a real orchestra playing in real time. So that's still being done.
Oh, my God. That was through Peter Matz, the great, great legendary arranger. Peter Matz, I did those two records with him. And those records were live. Peter and I worked on the arrangements for months. And then he went away and orchestrated it in a week and came back. And the first time I heard the orchestrations was in the studio live with a 40-piece orchestra.
Wow.
Like they used to do it. And I was in an isolated booth so we could fix things, but he wouldn't let me fix very much. And I was prepared. I trained like an athlete for this because we were cutting 20 songs in 2 days, difficult songs. So he wouldn't let me fix a lot. He said that was the experience. And I would say, but I could sing this better, but I could hold this longer, but I could... And he'd say, no, 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 that was true. That was real. So he made me pretty much leave it alone. He did the first 7 Streisand records. And if you listen to those records, it's the reality and the imperfection of some of those moments that make them so visceral and so powerful.
When you were recording the original cast recording of The Life, do you remember how long you were in the studio for that?
15 minutes. You know, they throw you in and you record it and you do 1 or 2 passes at every song.
That's it.
And it's live. There's nothing you fix. It's dreadful the way the cast albums are made. Dreamgirls, when they did Dreamgirls, they changed that. They came in and produced it like a record, and that record sounds incredible. For most cast records, they bring in live, you sing with the band, and you go home.
Among the people that you've met, we talked a little about Channing, you've met a lot of people over these years, a lot of these performers and creative artists. In your mind, who stands out just as like an over-the-top personality?
You know, I'm attracted to people who've been around long enough to understand the cycle of show business and life, the ups and downs, the survival of it. Liza Minnelli is one of my best friends. She's like my sister. Frank Langella is one of my very best friends. I've always been attracted. Sammy Davis Jr. took me under his wing. And these are big personalities, but they're also people who understand, like I said, the ups and downs, the roller coaster of a career. So many people go into something, this is it, this is my moment. That's not the way it is. You just work. You go in and you do your best work, and you try to stay out of the result or what it's supposed to be. And I think that that's why from a very young age, God, Roddy McDowell was one of my best friends when I was in my early 20s, and I've always been attracted to the people who are going to give me advice about living and doing this business. I've learned a great deal from a lot of those people.
I just saw that Joan Rivers documentary, and that's exactly what that Joan Rivers documentary is about.
Is it? I heard it's great. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's about surviving and going on. She'll take out her book. If it's all white space, her calendar, she goes, this is a bad week.
Uh-huh.
If it's filled up, and it doesn't matter how it's filled up because it's all about the work.
Right.
At your end, of course, now you're also a house husband with a child, so it's a little bit different, I would think.
Yes, I love it. I am above all a father. It's a great life. I'm a busy, busy person, and I'm tired all the time.
Well, when you're working on these cabaret shows, we were given a list of songs.
It'll change. Actually, we're changing it tonight. That's the fun of being with somebody. Todd Schroeder, my music director for 17 years, and we're like one person on the stage. He's so brilliant, and so we're able to say, let's try this, let's change this, let's do that, which you can't do when you have a band or an orchestra. You keep mentioning cabaret, and yes, I do this, but primarily I do theaters, concerts in theaters, which is the same thing as I'm doing here. Sometimes it's with Todd, sometimes it's with a band, sometimes it's with an orchestra.
Right.
But I don't do sets. I try to do a theatrical show that has an arc and has a sense of structure and has a sense of point. You know, that's the fun of it for me, is creating a theatrical evening instead of put some songs together. You know?
So you're going to work before you go on and try to find the story, the through line, even if no one else understands it, you do.
In sections. In sections.
Yeah.
I think it has an effect whether or not the audience is aware of that effect. The way you structure something, the way something leads into something, the way a story, without being on the nose, the way a story influences something as well, you know.
You seem to be ad-libbing quite a bit. Were you ad-libbing, or was that just part of the show?
Everything is written, and from that foundation, I am free to ad-lib. But if you there's a script.
Oh, there is.
If you read the script, you would see that a lot of what I say is written, and then from that I can riff. It's just like a song. There's the notes, there it is, and from that foundation, I can then go off.
I noticed that you try to balance older material with newer material.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself doing more in the way of your own original material or keep the mix going?
Depends on the venue, depends on the audience, it depends on the show, but it is, I've always have a really eclectic, in this show, I'm doing George Gershwin and Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton and Cy Coleman. Because they're all stories. They're all these little mini plays. And then when you put two or three of those together, they influence each other. That's really the fun of it for me.
What do you listen to now?
Sesame Street songs.
Well,
and,
come on.
the wheels on the bus go round and round. Honestly, that's what I listen to. I it's amazing how since having Cooper, I was telling the guys on the way over here, I seldom go to concerts or shows or buy CDs these days. I just don't. I just don't. I realize that right now I am reading the first book that's not about childcare in 2.5 years.
Well, what's the book?
It's a theater geek book. It's about that camp, that musical theater camp that the movie camp was sort of based on.
Right.
I can't remember what it's called, Stage Door Manor or something. It's in the Catskills. Somebody gave it to me for my birthday, and I thought, damn it, I'm going to read something besides child development books.
They have a Tony celebration in Hollywood, and so you're able, even if you're not on Broadway, you're able to see what's happening in musical theater today. What do you think is going on? I mean, this was a terrible year, except for a couple of decent jukebox shows.
Off-Broadway used to be the experimental place for Broadway. Off-Broadway is now the experimental place for off-Broadway. And Broadway, the commercialization of what's happening on Broadway is disconcerting. The jukebox spectacle of it all, and some of it's great, but a lot of it's vapid and heartless, somebody trying to get their money's worth. And it's about shows being the star so anybody can drop in, rather than creating vehicles about an event or something or someone that actually only a handful of people might be able to do.
Did you feel constrained in that regard, stepping into being your own performer?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you're Sam Harris, the performer.
Mm-hmm.
So when you step into a show on some level, people coming to see you, did you feel constrained at all playing Carmen Ghia, for instance, in Producers?
I'd never done that. I'd never stepped into a show that was up on Broadway. I'd done things from the beginning of that production before
right.
that. But I have to tell you that, yes, I'm coming to somebody else's show, somebody else is blocking, somebody else is creating something, but they let me really recreate a character from scratch. And Roger Bart was so wonderful, but it was very different from what I did. And also Gary Beach, who was playing Roger Debris, oh my God, he became my best friend. He's such a genius. And he would stir it up all the time. This is a man who loves long runs. And he would encourage me before I would go on the stage, because this character, when I would come on, would be discovered alone on the stage. This is how you've met him 30 minutes into the show on the phone in this outrageous, ridiculous set. And Gary would say to me, scare them. Scare them. He encourages you to fail, you know? Go out there and take a chance. Or he'd say, let's say we've had an argument before this scene. Something that would just inform us. Or he would say, let's say we've had a few cocktails. And so it would be something that we would play with to keep it alive and fresh. We were always changing it. But Mel Brooks also gave me a lot of freedom. I would say, hey, Mel, I've got a piece of shtick. Can we try this? You know.
And he would go, yeah.
Because, like, I could sing these crazy notes. And so Roger would do this sort of strange thing with his hands, this... I can't really do it, but I did it very well just then. And I didn't do it well, and so it was supposed to be shocking to them. And so I would sing this crazy high note, and we did the old shtick where, you know, the glass cracked, you know, or we would say, let's let a pigeon fall out from the ceiling. You know, I mean, we did vaudeville, and he let me do what I wanted to do, and Susan Stroman, too. She would say, here's the foundation, now take a leap.
And that was very different from working on a show like Joseph or Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh, sure. When I did Jesus Christ Superstar, that show was imagined so beautifully because I was allowed to really work on making Jesus a human being and not a deity. Just a guy that had a sense of humor and that was confused and in conflict, which I thought was really important because I feel like if somebody was that charismatic, they had to be accessible.
Doing all of these shows, how easy or hard is it to ensure that you never mail it in?
Oh, I'm sort of made fun of, even in rehearsal, because I don't mark anything, even in rehearsals. And I'm told, like, Sam, bring it down. But I don't ever discover anything when I'm walking through something. I've never done it. I'd be bored. I would be, why bother? And none of the people I respect would do that. It's live or die. It's risk-taking. You are putting yourself out there to discover something new every single time. And if you're trying to recreate something or phone something in or settling, how can you have a live experience?
On some level, you're ensuring that if someone saw it 10 times, in a way, they'd see 10 different shows.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah. And that's been lost, I guess, a lot in what we're seeing today with these cookie-cutter shows.
Automatrons is encouraged to a degree. With a real performer, with a real actor, you can't make that even happen. It is alive. It is fresh. It is new.
Sam Harris, what do you see in your own future at this point as a performer?
I love doing what I'm doing, and it takes lots of forms. Right now, I'm currently developing a television show that I love. This Jolson piece, this Jolson show.
And this is a biography of Al Jolson.
It's a biography, but it's not really, it's not a biopic. It's not something about the career of Al Jolson. It's about the psychology. It's the peeling of the onion of this really fascinating, complex man who loved to be on the stage. And I share that sort of ravenous need to do what I do. But he is very dark and interesting and wonderful, and that's definitely in the works.
Al Jolson, strange character. He was a superstar and then kind of vanished.
He did vanish, and then he reemerged.
With those two movies.
With those two movies, and then he became larger in some ways than ever, which was really odd because he was singing those songs that were from the 20s and early 30s, and all of a sudden in the 50s, he became, you know, Bobby Soxers were listening to his songs. And then he sort of disappeared again, and it's because of the blackface thing. You know, it was just horribly inappropriate, which is something we deal with in the show.
Well, how do you, at your end, as the performer, because, I mean, you obviously can do pretty good mimicry when you set your mind to it, but you don't want to mimic Al Jolson. How do you create that balance between making sure people see it's Jolson and at the same time being Sam Harris?
I think you have to nod to it. I think you have to give enough of it that is, that you understand that it's from a biographical perspective, which affects certain aspects of my voice or my body or my movement, but I'm not doing an impersonation any more than Barbra Streisand did an impersonation of Fanny Brice. I think there's enough that's in common, but the spirit is the same. When I sing those songs, I don't sound like him, but I think that I believe that we share the same energy. Does that make sense?
Sam Harris, have you ever thought of writing your memoirs?
I have, actually. There's a publishing company that I've been in beginning talks about doing something that may be anecdotal. I mean, I know I've had a lot of experience. It's about which direction it should take. Should it take a show business perspective, and that are my anecdotes about Sammy Davis Jr. and my life and what, you know, Liza Minnelli or Carol Channing, like we were talking about? Or is it about somebody emerging from being in Oklahoma to becoming, you know, going into show business and then all of a sudden being a father and husband in a new gay society? Who knows? Who knows?
You've been listening to an interview with Sam Harris, who has a CD available called Free, and a new
among others,
and a new song called My Reclamation, which I guess you can listen to on, you know, through YouTube and download from iTunes. At the Raz Room in San Francisco, shows through Sunday. People could find out more by going online. And on Saturday, tomorrow, signing CDs, talking with people from 1 to 3 at the HRC store in the Castro as part of Pride Weekend. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.